All right, hi everybody, and welcome to Lecture 25 in this American History program of History at Our House for the elementary class. We are not going to start today with a facts practice. Instead, I want to spend a little bit of time talking about a few parts of the program for all of you as students and for all of you as moms and dads as well. And I might start to make this a regular feature of the class that I take the first 5 minutes on Mondays to talk about how we do things at History at Our House. Take a little extra time to talk about some of the things that we do and what it's like to use a program like History at Our House as a homeschooler and some of the advice that I might have to give you about how you do it. Okay? And today I have advice to give about two things. One is facts practice, and the other is geography. And they are very connected. Okay, so I want to now share my screen with you guys and show you the class webpage. Right, this is the lower elementary class webpage for October. And I noticed this weekend that I had forgotten to update the geography resources on the class webpage. And there was one person that contacted me for a reminder about that. And so I realized, I had forgotten to do certain things. So, for instance, on the class webpage for August and September, assuming I can get the class webpage to go there. Da, 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 da. We can wait forever. Okay, I hope not. Sometimes the internet is slow. Even our high-speed, fast internet in this world. Jeremy, you're late, so if you're confused, you're just going to have to figure it out. All right, so what we are doing here is we're talking about what you are... I'm giving you some guidance here about how to use the program, and I wanted you to see that on the class webpage at the end of week 5 already, there had been some test preparation sheets, and I think I talked about this in class before, but I may not, and an orientation to geography testing and to geography. And so after this was put on the class webpage, I kind of forgot to keep it up. And like I said, some people reminded me about it, and so the test did not get posted until today. So if you now go to the current class webpage and you look on week 6, there is a geography test for American geography, and there it is, USA Geography, and it's got all this stuff that's explained to your parents in the orientation to geography. So I recommend, just like I recommend in general that you do facts practice, I recommend that as part of your learning of history, you learn to identify the geography of the world and the geography of the United States. Because, well, let me see, if you guys could take a crack at this, what's the reason to learn geographical names? To learn the geography of the world. What's the connection between that and history? Anna?
You unmuted me. Did you mean to unmute Anna?
I'm sorry, Abby. Yes.
It's because so that you can know where things are happening. Like if somebody says, this happened in Boston, you know that's in Boston, Massachusetts, or something like that.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's right, Abby. In other words, history. What have we got on the facts practice sheet? The facts practice sheet has a special question that's a history question. It's called when. When did something happen? But guess what? There's also who. There's also what. And then what's the other one? Where? Nothing in history happens. Everything in history happens in a place. Nothing doesn't happen. I don't know how to put that negatively. There isn't anything that doesn't happen somewhere. Okay? So you can't say mayonnaise and armor unified and then finish, and then that's it. That period. That's the end of the sentence. What are you talking about? Imagine if we said, in 1492, Christopher Columbus discovered. Period. What the heck is going on here? What did we lose? We lost the what, Patrick?
Where?
We lost the where. So this is not possible to study history without the where part. We need the when, and guess what? We need the others too. We need the who and the what, right? It wouldn't make sense to say, wouldn't this be ridiculous if we said, in 1492, blank, discovered America. All right, now we've got history without the who. Circa 4 BC, blank was born. What? Now we're missing the who. That doesn't make any sense. Or if we said in 1776 the founding fathers. Well, now wait a minute. We're missing the what? Right? So, oh my gosh. You see, you can't have history without the answer to all of these questions. Now, here's what's so important when it comes to geography. There's a lot of it. And when we go and we say that Christopher Columbus discovered something, or that the pilgrims went somewhere, or that the founding fathers signed the declaration in a certain place, there's quite a few of those. And there's really only one way to know those. There's only one way to know them. What is it? Anybody know? Well, it's right there in the geography work that you do. Do a variety of things to help you, in the end, to do one thing, Rosetta.
Learn them?
Yeah, but in particular, to memorize them. They are basic facts. A geographical place name is a basic fact. There's nothing you can do with the name New York except memorize it. It might serve you some good purpose to say, oh, it's new, and there was a place in England called York, and little interesting things like that, little tidbits about things. But that doesn't help you to find it on a map, and it doesn't help you to remember the name so much. With names of places, you just have to learn them, and then, Rosetta, memorize them. And so a lot of information that we learn as we are growing up and as we are being educated, a lot of information is like that. And it's important to recognize that and take that seriously. And I think, there's a tie-in here between geography and facts practice. A lot of people are afraid of memorization in history. A lot of people are afraid of it. They think that they remember, especially grown-ups remember, that they memorized a lot of stuff on tests that they took when they were kids, and it was worthless and useless. And believe you me, I did a lot of that. And I got plenty of good grades because I knew how to do it. And a lot of people have done that jumping through hoops routine of memorizing stuff and then forgetting it. Okay, and so people are afraid of that nowadays. Now, in history at our house, it's hard to recognize, I think, and this is part of my guidance, my advice for you guys. It's hard to recognize that the stuff that we memorize is not like the stuff that people have been accustomed to memorize in history. People tend to memorize a whole lot of useless stuff. When they were kids, that's what they thought it was. History was what we memorize in American history, in any kind of history, is only information that we have already learned, and information that we can answer a very special question about. And it's not who, it's not what, it's not where, it's not when. There's only a certain kind of information that if we don't answer another question, we don't memorize. What's that other question? Dana, what's that other question?
So what?
So what? In other words, it has to be worthy information. It has to be powerful information, useful information. That's what we memorize. And there's nothing wrong with that. And if anybody thinks there is, they have to really think this through. Because I guarantee you, everybody here has memorized a certain number of letters and the sounds that they make and knows how to use them, right? Isn't that useful information? Or should we relearn that every single day of our lives? Let's not bother committing the sound of the letter A to memory, right? Basic information. No, let's learn that over and over every day. Let's Google it every day. No, it doesn't make sense. All the stuff that we know how to do, including 2 plus 2, and 2 times 2, and 6 times 8, and all that stuff we memorize because we learn it, we figure it out, and then we don't want to waste our time having to relearn it over and over and over again. So we memorize it. And then we move on. So, in history, we do need to do this, and we need to do two different kinds, mainly. We need to memorize a lot of where stuff. So that's the geography part of the class, and I want you to try to take a closer look at it now, and you'll notice, and I know, and I apologize for this, that I didn't get everything on the class webpage very quickly, but it's back, and I would encourage everybody to take a closer look at it and get back to it now that Mr. Powell is kind of back on the ball here. I want you to get back to this and pay attention to it, especially if you don't know American geography. And then the other part is facts practice, okay? The who, what, where, and when of a lot of really, really important information that will help us later on, mostly, in our studies of history, if we know it automatically and don't have to remember it and think about it. Okay, Abby, you have a question or comment about that?
I was actually not aware that we were supposed to do the geography. I thought that was a whole different class.
Well, I'm not sure why you thought that, but I understand that maybe I didn't explain it enough. So I apologize for that. But, I mean, basically, if it's on this webpage, then it's a part of your program, isn't it? Doesn't that make sense? So, I think that I didn't explain it enough. So I apologize, Abby. And I'll have to think about how to do more orientation to the program for parents so that there aren't these confusions in other years of the program. Abby, go ahead again.
I also wanted to ask something. What is the, test difficulty levels?
Well, that's explained in the orientation to geography testing. So if you are going to resume or start up in your geography, you need to start in week 1 and work your way through, and all your questions will be answered if you work along that program. Okay, I can't do that in class. It's too complicated. So there's a whole video explaining that. All right, now what we need to do is tomorrow we are going to do Facts Practice 1B. So please have it ready. Back up here, Facts Practice 1B. And so now, today though, we need to move on. I'm sorry. What did I just do? Let me do this one more time. Down here at the bottom, you'll notice today is lecture 25. And I have the class notes for the rebirth, the Renaissance material that we have been talking about. And today we need to add another little piece of the puzzle here. Abby, put your hand down unless you still have a question, but I'd really like to move on. Okay, so let's talk about this. The title of today's lecture is The Birth of Modern Printing. But, all right, so let's just kind of get ourselves thinking about what we're talking about again here in this time, around 1492. We're talking about, as the class notes, actually not a bad idea to just go look at the class notes. How about somebody who's a really strong reader read this out loud for the class, this introductory paragraph here from the lower elementary class notes. Any really strong reader want to do that for the group? Dana, please.
the shaping of a new world. In this part of the course, we will look at some of the important ways the world was changing around 1492, taking people out of the Dark Ages and making life more like it is today. The discovery of America by Columbus was part of an age of discovery. It was a part of a rebirth of ancient Greek and Roman knowledge known as the Renaissance. Finally, Christianity broke up into separate beliefs or sects, causing more wars between its already separate peoples during the Reformation.
Okay, thank you, Dana. All right, so we're talking about three things here that are highlighted in this paragraph. The Age of Discovery, which is coming up. The Renaissance, which we've been talking about. And this other set of changes called the Reformation. Okay, so that's what we're kind of talking about here. And so far, we looked at the rebirth of freedom. And last week, we spent some time explaining what that is, how the ancient Greeks and Romans had worked to create better governments in ancient times. And we know that from our anchor facts, when they did that. Right? When? Let's do a quick facts practice. When did the Greeks and Romans do that? Patrick?
Okay, circa 508 BC / circa 509 BC.
Okay, good, right. Okay, so about 500 BC is when they did that. They made something called democracy, where the majority rules, and they made, the Romans made, a republic, where you have something called a constitution and other things that do something very special that's better than a democracy. What's the crucial idea that you have in a democracy that's that you have in a republic that's missing in the idea of a democracy? Let's get those straight. What does a republic have that a democracy does not have? Abby?
A constitution which protects individual rights.
Right. A constitution and other things, but a constitution is the main one we've learned that protects individual rights. That's the crucial idea that's even stronger. So the Athenians created a democracy, and nowadays everybody's all excited about voting, and people will teach you plenty about voting. But we also have to focus on the fact that there's some things you can't do when you vote. And there's a whole set of laws out there that says what the government can and cannot do. Very important. Because if the government can do whatever it wants, well, then that's called ruling. And you don't want to be ruled. No good. Okay. So we got that rebirth of that. And last week we connected it to the rebirth of art, the kind of art that the Greeks and Romans had created. And also to the rebirth of science, the kind of science that the Greeks and Romans had created also in their ancient times. Well, now, what we're going to look at is that while these things were being reborn, and thanks to a lot of this stuff that was being reborn, some new things that had never been were being born also. One of the great things about the Renaissance is that it wasn't just a rebirth. Because if it was just a rebirth, where would we be living now? it's a little bit of a joke, but basically, if ancient Greece and Rome had come back, then what? How would we be dressed right now? And what languages would we be speaking? And what would life be like, Abby? Go ahead.
We would probably be dressed in togas and other European clothes, maybe pantaloons, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Maybe, we would probably be speaking Latin or Greek or maybe Spanish.
Yeah, right. We'd be speaking Latin and Greek. We'd be walking around in togas. We'd have a very, very different life. So it's not like the rebirth was just, let's turn the clock back and we're going to be just like the Greeks and the Romans. The rebirth was, okay, look at this stuff that we forgot. We've been living in the Dark Ages. We didn't know. We forgot about all these wonderful things that the Greeks and Romans did. So let's bring those back. But more importantly, let's start acting like Greeks and Romans. Let's go see if we can do that sort of stuff ourselves. And if we start thinking about nature ourselves, if we start making beautiful art ourselves, well, we're not just going to be copying old things. We're going to be making new things. That's what the Greeks and Romans did, right? They, when they did the birth, they weren't copying somebody else. They were making new things. That's the real way to be a Greek and a Roman, to make new things that people haven't made ever before. So the people of the Renaissance were becoming more creative, more inventive. And in particular, there was a man named Johannes Gutenberg who invented a new kind of technology called the printing press. Now, this, it's hard to imagine anything more important than this. Because imagine we were going back to the ancient way of the Greeks and Romans. And we want our ideas, whatever thing we invent or create, or we are a writer of a story or a poem, and we want those ideas and that information to go to other people. How does it happen? How do ideas and information move? How do people teach other people? How does knowledge get passed on from one person to another? And how does it grow? So, Patrick, what's your thought there?
Of course, it's libraries, books, and probably usually schools.
Okay, nice answers. Libraries and books with libraries with books in them and schools. Okay, well, guess what? In the Dark Ages, they had very, very few of those. And why did they have so few? Why are there so few books and so few libraries? Well, because maybe Abby knows this. She's eager to share some thoughts. Go ahead.
Few people were educated.
Very few people were educated, and we think of education, what are the basics? Reading, writing, and arithmetic, right? Well, could people read and write in the Dark Ages? No! And all the books, as Anna is saying, how did books even get made, Anna?
People wrote them by hand.
People had to write books by hand. So I was just kind of talking with Patrick the other day about how his favorite books, like he's starting to read these longer books, that they're still kids' books, but they might be 300 pages. And I said to him, how long do you think it would take to make one of these books that's 300 pages if you had to write it out by hand? And so we came up with, well, maybe about 3 pages a day if you were really, really dedicated to writing. It's pretty hard to do. And so 300 pages would take how many days, Patrick? At 3 pages a day.
100.
100 days for one person to make a book? Yes?
And that means that you can only, that back in the Dark Ages, you could only make 3 books a year.
3 books a year if you're one person. So no wonder there aren't a lot of books around. Right? No wonder there isn't a lot of learning in the Dark Ages, because it's going to take you 100 days to make a book. And only the people who can read and write can make them in the first place. What pretty much everybody else is doing is trying to grow enough wheat to get a loaf of bread to eat and take care of the goats because they need a little milk and the chickens for some eggs. And there's not much else to do because life is really, really hard. So almost nobody knew how to read and write, and the ones that did had to make books by hand. Oh my gosh. So, 3 pages a day. Well, along comes this guy called Johannes Gutenberg, and I should get a picture of him here. Let's see if I can put Johannes, because he deserves to be on our page. Gutenberg. Okay, if we go over here, there's a picture of good old Johannes. Let's get a bigger picture, because he deserves to have his picture up here. Along comes this man called Johannes Gutenberg, and he figures out a way to make a printing press, which is a machine that allows you to make little blocks for each letter and line them up together so that you make words, and then make lots of copies of the same thing over and over and over again. And I'm going to find you guys a good video link to show you. Here is a man in a museum showing people a page that he made. And this video is called How a Gutenberg Printing Press Works. I don't like the video very much because I don't like the way that he teaches it, but it might be the best that we can do. So I might just give you a link to this one to show you how the Gutenberg printing press worked. But basically, he put a piece of paper inside the machine and pressed down, and bam, what do you have? A whole page full of text. And you could do this a few thousand times a day. So I was talking to Patrick. I was saying, if you had a mechanical invention, you start off and you're doing it by hand, and you can do about 3 pages a day writing, maybe 4 if you're fast. Well, guess what? The Gutenberg printing press would allow you to make 3,000 pages a day to 4,000 pages a day. So how many more books are we going to get? Now, that's way more than that, Anna. What's the difference between 3 and 3,000? How many times faster is that, Patrick? How many times faster? 3 and 3,000. Dana's got it right. 1,000. It's not just a lot, Caleb. It's 1,000 times faster. So books could be made about 1,000 times faster. That's like a superpower. Right? Imagine if you could run 1,000 times faster than a normal human being. That's what we call a superhero, right? Well, human beings became superheroes because of Johannes Gutenberg. They started to be able to make 1,000 pages of text in a day. That's not possible to a normal person who has to write. Yes, Patrick.
Well, that means that with the printing press, you can make 10 books a day.
Exactly. Nice math. Good. Good math. 3,000 pages, a book of 300 pages, that means you can make 10 books a day. Not one book every 100 days, but 10 books every single day. And before you know it, because this invention was so awesome, the people of Europe were very excited. Let me show you a map. By the time of Columbus's discovery, these are all the printing presses in Europe. So this is a map. You guys recognize what this is, right? Got to know your geography. Italy, right? Spain, England, France. This is Europe, right? And these dots show you over in when you have a big dot, it means more than, this is kind of a funny thing. But it means that more and more printing presses. Let's just leave it at that for the time being. So they're using a funny word in here that I like, but it's hard to explain. So these are all the printing presses in Europe by the time of Columbus, and they're printing lots of books. They're printing the Bible for Christians, right? Because that mattered a lot to people. But they're also printing a lot of other books. And I'm going to show you one of the books that they printed. So let's put... Okay, here's a page printed from a Gutenberg printing press. And somebody has been scribbling notes in the side of the page. Do you guys do that when you read? You're probably not allowed to. I like to scribble notes in my books. Grown-ups are allowed to. Ha ha. That's part of being a grown-up. You're allowed to scribble in the side. So this book here, I'm not going to tell you what it is just yet, but I'm going to tell you who's scribbling the notes. Guess who's scribbling the notes? Christopher Columbus. So this book belonged to Christopher Columbus. So he liked to read. He actually taught himself how to read. And he was reading this book, which is in Latin, so that's why you can't read it. And he was making notes in the side margin. And I'm going to show you another version of this book that has some nice art in it, and then maybe you can guess what Christopher Columbus was reading. Here we go. Here's what Christopher Columbus was reading. Here's another version of it. And I'm going to zoom in on the picture and tell me what the heck was he reading. What do you see in this strange image that you would never find in Europe? Anybody recognize this animal? What is this, Patrick?
Is it an elephant?
It's an elephant, yeah. With the tusk, and it wasn't drawn very accurately, but it's an elephant. And because this book has something to do with Asia, not with Europe. So what book was it that Christopher Columbus was reading that got him really excited to maybe see if he could go there? Jeremy, do you know? Okay. Abby, what about you?
The book that Marco Polo wrote after his journey to the Indies, nicknamed The 1,000 Lies.
Yeah. Well, somebody called it that, right? But basically it's known as The Travels of Marco Polo is the usual name. And certainly not all of it was true, but we know basically that it was mostly true. So we'll focus on the truths rather than the lies. So The Travels of Marco Polo, a person from Europe who had been to China. And where did Columbus end up trying to get to? China, Asia, going west. We're about to get the age of discovery here because we have books all over the place telling us about the world. People are having more and more chances to read fantastic stories and to be inspired to learn new things and do new things. And we have a reader, Christopher Columbus, reading about Asia and becoming inspired and saying, I want to go there. I want to go to this land of elephants and tall mountains and everything and see what the people over there have and trade with them. Okay? So we're getting close here to our age of discovery because we've got books. And we got thousands more books than we ever had because we got a printing press. All right, people are starting to read more. There's starting to be more schools. Christopher Columbus is reading. Oh, this is getting good. Now we're getting the modern world is being shaped here. Okay, Jeremy, put your hand down unless you still have a question. Okay, folks. We're getting close here. We're getting close. So tomorrow we're going to start talking about books about geography and about people learning about the world beyond just the writings of Marco Polo. Okay. Good. Thanks, everybody. Good luck with the facts practice and the geography, and keep it going. Talk to you tomorrow. Bye.
Chappelle.
Bye.
Chappelle. Bye. Bye.